Jaya Vishnu Pada Pramanasa Diva Jakacharya Stutara Sata Shishimad Israelisha Esi Bhakti Vrata Sanharaya Shri Prabhupada Ki Iskand Founder Acharya Shri Prabhupada Ki Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Nama Acharya Shri Haridas Thakura Ki Vem Sevi Ho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityana Vishri Vedeta Radhara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakti Vrinda Ki Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopu Gopina Shyama Kunda Radha Kani Giri Govardhana Ki Shri Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Shri Mayapur Dhamma Ki Tandamaya Ki So this is like an introduction of what's going on and what this particular school is. And then we'll seriously start exactly what we're studying from on Friday. So basically speaking is that first thing is understand the academy, what the academy is, what it's for. So the academy then is to establish basically its focus is on Srimad Bhagavatam as given by Srila Prabhupada and the previous acharyas and their books that then give this same viewpoint. And a study of the acharyas' books which are in that same light. It means they are always in support of the conclusion of the Bhagavatam. Like that. So, means any educational institution, generally it always has a prominent book. What it is, like you have one school, grammar may be prominent, or another, Jyotish may be prominent, or Ayurveda may be prominent, or Vedanta may be prominent, or the Puranas, of the Puranas, particular Purana. So for us, then the prominent is Srimad Bhagavatam. That's the first principle, is that Bhagavatam being the conclusion of all the Vedic literatures, then it is the book that is the main focus, it is the main study. But now in this, then there must be an understanding and appreciation of how Bhagavatam is that book. Because otherwise devotees will just say, yeah, Bhagavatam, and that's, you know, there, and everybody will agree to that. But to actually understand that it's there, that it is the conclusion. Because we see that when it comes down to material knowledge, generally devotees turn to any other book other than Bhagavatam. And in doing so, that's one thing, maybe details they'll get from another literature. That's understood, because the conclusion or the essence doesn't get into the detail. It tells you what is the actual purpose of that detail, what is the actual use of those details that you get from every other scripture. But the problem is they'll approach these other literatures without the Bhagavatam's viewpoint. They will take the book on its own, as it stands on its own. So this is a big problem, because so much effort has been done. Vyasadeva has taken the one Veda and divided it into four. Then he's given all the supplementary literatures. And from those supplementary literatures, then he's brought together like the essence of all of them into the Mahabharata. So that means the essence of all the detail. And, you know, what is the most important aspect of the detail of all of Vedic literatures. And then after that, and then given the glimpse of the spiritual, how to actually connect it to the spiritual, to the Gita. But that's 700 verses out of 100,000. So this is the difficulty, is that whatever is in all the Vedic literatures, you will find in the Mahabharata. But what's in the Mahabharata may not be found in the other literatures. Because Vyasadeva very cleverly writes in the essence, you know, the most important principles and elements of every one of the Vedic scriptures. And then he gives the essence of transcendence. So in this, might be good to back up a little bit. Understand what are the Vedic literatures. The Vedic literatures comprise of two categories of books. One category is the transcendental literature. That's called Paravidya. You know, that's what we're most used to. Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. Like this. The Upanishads, Vedanta Sutra. These are considered transcendental. But then, the other books, out of 14 books, the other 13, those are considered material. So the Vedic literature, the Veda, four Vedas themselves, the various branches of Sanskrit, of astrology, of ritual, means of the Vedic yagyas and sacrifice, then the Dharma Shastras, the Niti Shastras, the Nyaya Shastras, and the histories. These are all considered to be material knowledge. But it's material knowledge that is inherently dovetailed in the Lord's service. So that makes it apara. It's not para, meaning transcendental, it's apara, meaning non-transcendental, but dovetailed. Then when apara vidya is not engaged properly in upliftment or going back to Godhead, then it becomes called avidya. Right? Ignorance. The same book. You can take, let's say, astrology. The books in astrology, if you're using them for your spiritual advancement, then they're called aparavidya. If you're just using them to make charts and make money, it's called avidya, or ignorance. And this is the Vedic literatures. Right? So anything that's non-Vedic doesn't even count. It's automatically called avidya, because even though it can be engaged in the Lord's service, you're engaging avidya in the Lord's service. Because knowledge means it's based or founded on the Vedic principles. Otherwise, what is the important principle? You take a book. What is the important principle? Who's decided it's important? Right? What is the purpose? Because you see, all the Vedic literatures start from the Lord, come down into the material energy as far as their body of knowledge begins. Right, where it connects to the Lord's creation. Then they explain the body of knowledge and then they take it back up to the Lord. That's the way the Vedic literatures work. They start from the Lord, come down into the material energy, deal with the subject, and then go back out. But the other ones just deal inside and it's speculative. Where does it come from? Has it come from any parampara that's coming from the Lord? No, it's coming from someone who's observed, an intelligent person, who has spent the time and effort to observe the material energy, see some patterns like that, and then make some theories on those patterns, what they are, the patterns, how they interact with each other, what are the results of those particular patterns, you know, how you could apply those patterns. But it's still speculative because they don't know its connection to the Lord. So how broad is that particular body of knowledge? They have no idea. They wouldn't have a clue. Therefore, it's speculation. They may have observed some things, but that's called pratyaksha. By the senses. They observe by their senses, not by something else. So therefore, it's just like the scientists. And Prabhupada says, that's speculation. It may be pretty well educated. You know, like you say, here's an educated guess. That's all it is. It's an educated guess. People may be offended. But after 10 years, it changes. So how can it be anything else? Truth means it's true today, it's true tomorrow, it's true after a million years, it was true a million years ago. Right? You can say dogs bark. Okay. Because they did before, they do in the future. But how do you know they always bark? Because by the modern paradigm, you can't say. Previously they may have squeaked. And then squeaking didn't work. Nobody took them seriously. So then they all got together and decided that they would transform into, you know, a bark. Like that, you know. You know, just like seeing one cartoon where there were these living entities that looked like whales. They had the whole head and body of a whale, but they had arms, you know, feet and back legs. And they were sitting there on the side of the ocean, you know, and looking out at Noah's Ark going out into the water. You know, they were sitting there, you know, and one of them looks at the other and said, you know, what did he say? You know, and the other one said, he said, you better learn to swim. So then you got whales. Right? And it means, according to Darwin's theory, whales, their connection is to bears. Right? Because bears were there catching fish, and I guess one of them fell in and they had to learn how to swim, or they decided, hey, why should we be on the land and catch these fish? We'll just go in the water and then we'll catch them there.
They actually say that first they came, everyone came from the water and came up to land. Then once they were on land, then some entities, they decided, well, not to go back into the waters of mammals. It's a bear thing.
Yes, because they went back into the mammals. You know, as if you make a choice, you know. It's like all the guys sit around, hey, the girls aren't interested, you know, maybe we should look like, whoever it is. You know, John Wayne says, okay, let's transform, you know. Like that, so over a few generations, and you know, you had a whole country that looked like John Wayne, stuff like that, right? I mean, that's it sounds ridiculous, but that's what Darwin's theory is. So the point is that there's no difference in any modern branch of knowledge. It's just as speculative. Though they may have observed very nicely, it works, but then after a few years, a new book comes out that replaces the old one. There's very few classic books. At least in the body of straight knowledge. You know, even something like Einstein, many of the people just say he didn't know what he was talking about. And others say no one understands what he was talking about. You have two schools there. Some say what he was talking was so high that today's scientists can't understand it. And others say, no, we've gone beyond it. So that nothing's sacred, you know. Maybe a few of the literatures, okay, people still occasionally talk about the Iliad and the, you know, and Odyssey, or they may read Beowulf, you know, stuff like this, some old literatures like that. But otherwise, there's the branches of knowledge are speculative. So how to manage, how to work your life, how to make men and women relationships work. You know, you take, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. You boil it down, and the essence that actually makes it work is already there in the Vedic literatures. Right? Already knowing what man is like, woman is like, therefore the duties have been assigned. You know? But here they have to go through, and because some scientist has said it, some professor, we can accept that. But if the Vedic literatures, that's old. You know, so that's the point, is because modern knowledge, if you're not up to date within the last few years, it's outdated. So the same, we have to be very careful that the same concept we don't throw onto the Vedic literatures. Vedic literatures are never outdated. They're always up to date because they're dealing with eternality. So they always have been and always will be applicable. Like that. So that's one of the main points that Madhu makes. Is that those who don't believe this point, who feel that the logic and their ability of their own intellectual prowess is more important than what's given in the Vedic literatures, he says one should avoid such association, one should not marry into those families, one should not teach those kind of people, one shouldn't deal with them at all. Like that. He makes that point. Right in the beginning of the book, before he starts actually establishing the laws. So that's the principle that's there, is that the Vedic literatures can only be studied by those who have faith in them. Because it is coming down from authority. Right? So the whole point is then whatever actually works is already in the Vedic literatures. You may have to apply it time, place, and circumstance, but that doesn't change the principles. Right? The Vedic literature, what always works is the principle. So what happens is people observe generally some details and they put it together. Very few actually get to the point of observing a principle. Right? If somebody observes a principle, then people still talk about it today. Right? You take something like Newton's third law. Okay, that's the principle. You know? So that still remains. But so many other things, people change. You know, because it's a detail. The detail is according to time, place, and circumstance. So the person that has observed it and come up with these things, he's observed it in a particular way. And then because of that, then it applies to that circumstance. You change the circumstance. If they don't know the principle, you can't apply it anymore. So the better it's observed, the more they're coming close to those principles, or they caught a few principles. But the idea is, why go to such trouble? Why not just go to the source and get directly from there what is actually going on? And then functioning from those principles, then you take time, place, and circumstance and apply it. Then you actually get something solid. That's what the Vedic literatures are recommending. Because otherwise, how long will it go on? It's so speculative. Right? So the whole approach is different in that they're similar. If you want knowledge, means you have to accept the teacher, you have to accept what they say. That works in any branch. But the difference is that that it's a matter of understanding or having faith in authority. Not just for the teacher, because the Mayavadis also approach a guru and take initiation. But then when they become mature, then they become the guru. So they reject the guru, because they become God. God doesn't need a guru. So that's the modern. You have your teacher and your mentor, and they're your teacher, you know, as long as, you know, they're kind of still on the top of the pile. But as soon as they move from the top of the pile, or you've come up with theories and stuff that are, you know, once you've finished your PhD and you've gotten, you know, situated, then it's actually individual whether you maintain that relationship with that teacher or not. You can develop your own theories, go off in a different direction, contradict what your teacher has said. As long as you're in a powerful enough position to support it and get away with it, you can do it. Like that. So then you become the teacher. You become the guru, rather than it's something there. So even though it's externally similar, doesn't really have that principle. So we can see is that the methods of teaching, they learn from observation. And so many times they see what works in different situations. But the foundation of what they're teaching is purely speculative. So the system itself of modern education is speculation. It's an experiment. Because it's always changing. There are always dilemmas that they're trying to work out. You know, do you put the knowledge in? Do you draw the knowledge out? You know, is it phonetic or is it linguistic? Or they have all these wild theories they can't work out. And these have been problems for hundreds of years. Like that, because it's a speculative system, you know. His math was going along very nicely up into the 60s, and every kid learned math, and he brought out new math, and then people just didn't learn math anymore. Then after doing a few years of new math, they figured out nobody knew math, so they had to do something that was in between. But the old math system worked perfectly fine, right? But kids couldn't concentrate and focus, so they had to come up with something different because their audience was less qualified. So the whole point we're trying to get down to is then the Vedic literatures actually describe factually how the material world works and how to deal with it on all levels, you know, sense gratification, economics, religion, liberation, politics, justice, medicine, architecture, whatever it is, it deals with it. There's nothing that the Vedic literatures don't deal with. So then it's a matter of, if we take that as a paradigm, that we accept this and believe this, then it's a matter of now we have to apply what's there. Right? Does that make it, we understand that?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if we take it that, well, the Vedic literatures don't really have, then we have to search somewhere else, and then we won't look at the Vedic literatures because we already know they don't have. So I might as well look somewhere else. But if we accept that they know what is going on, then one has to accept it. Then it's a matter of, well, I must see how it applies. So then it's a matter of, since it does say, then we have to figure out how it does apply. Then we have to learn. You see the difference in the approach? Like that. Because if it doesn't apply, then why bother with it? Why waste the time, right? When people are practical, they don't have much time. They have to get the work done. But if it does have all the answers, then it's a matter of, I don't see the answer, then it's a matter of, that means me. I don't know. But most people who have a brain don't want to be on that side of the equation. You know, that they themselves are the X factor. You know, it's that they know what's going on and something else is the X factor. Like that. So that's the point, is that they don't want to be the one that, I don't know, I'm the idiot, I'm the fool. But that's why Sanatana Goswami is so great. He is the prime minister for the Nawab of East India. Because when I say Bengal, in those days Bengal meant half of Orissa, East and West Bengal now, and Assam. You know? And then Manipur was its own kingdom. So that's a huge amount. And it also was parts of Bihar and Madhya Pradesh, you know, because lately they've, you know, traded off things and stuff. There's a huge area, and you know, traditionally you have, that means the largest amount of, I think it's the most populated state, I think, is Bengal. Bengal, maybe UP. UP's huge. Bengal's very small. This little dinky West Bengal, in the 1982 census, it had 100 million. Right? That was 20 years ago. I don't know what's the latest, what they say. You know, so it was a big kingdom. He was the prime minister. He spoke Sanskrit. He spoke Bengali. You know, he spoke Persian. Right? He could sit with 30 Brahmins and discuss Bhagavatam. Right? That means he could engage 30. It wasn't as they were all sitting around. You know, it means that 30 people, they could bring up points and this and carry on a discussion that was at the depth that it would keep Sanatana Goswami engaged, keep him busy. Right? And when he comes before Lord Chaitanya, he says, I'm a fool. People say, means in the world, he's famous as an educated person, but he's saying, I know nothing, because I don't really know who I am. You know, meaning practical. He knows he's not the body, but as far as practically applying it, then he's finding some difficulty. So then he considers himself uneducated. So if we take that principle, is that I don't know, and by Guru Sahib and Shastra, I can know. They can show me what is the essence. They can show me how to apply it in my life. Then that's intelligent, then we can actually progress. So that's the first principle in education, is humility. That I don't know. I want to know. I have a need to know. That's pranipata. And pariprashna, then one inquires submissively. And sevaya, one applies it in one's life, one practices it. So that combination then makes for a proper study and knowledge. So if that is there, then we will say that, okay, now these Vedic literatures, they contain everything. Because Vyasadeva is God's literary incarnation. That means God's ability to write literature is invested in Vyas. That means you're not going to get a better writer than him. Right? It means if you look at it, devotees will look at it, you know, some of these Vedic literature, oh, they're so complicated and so convoluted. No, that's because they're so amazingly written, that they can have many, many themes going at once and different layers and different literary devices. They used literary devices that you don't see. You just don't see. I was looking at one, seeing one today in the Mahabharata, is that, like, if you want to describe a place, how nice it is and details about it, if you put too much in one place, people get bored. So then Vyasadeva used a technique where where Damayanti walks into the ashram of these sages and observes something about it, you know, the beauty of it and the wild animals and all this and the trees and its niceness and all that. And then it stops there. Then she meets the sages, they discuss a little bit, and after giving her some blessings and advice, then they and their ashram disappears. Right? Then she is thinking, was that real or was it a dream? Because it just disappeared. You know, because these weren't ordinary sages. They just happened to be three of Lord Brahma's sons. Right? There was Bridhu Atri and Bridhu Atri. I can't remember who the third one was. But they were all Brahma's, you know, original 10 sons. So then she's thinking, and then in thinking about it, you know, where are the nice trees? She described the trees. Where's the nice river that was there? Where was the nice ashram? So then further description was given of the place after, you know, but now from her memory. So it's not even just she was telling somebody else how nice it is. It was even just from her memory. Did it even exist? So it's being done in the form of questions. Right? So describing something through questions is a very also unique method. Like Narad Muni comes and he asks something like 30 questions or 30, 40 questions to Yudhishthira. Each question is rhetorical. It has its own answer. It's the question itself, you know. Are you paying your soldiers, you know, their wages on time? So that means soldiers must be paid their wages on time. You know? Are your citizens feeling protected and, you know, or like this, you know? Are you balancing, you know, your artha kama and dharma? You know, all these different things, you know? So it's just all these amazing techniques are being used. And so then, in his maturity, then the Bible talks about it. So it's the most mature of all literature. So it just seems, yeah, there's Bhagavatam. That's because it's way over our heads. You know, we take it. If we don't grasp it, it must be not so important, you know. It's very simple. Okay, Prabhupada gave us the essence, so we understand we're not the body, Krishna's God. You know, we need to chant Hare Krishna to develop love for God. Okay. Been there, done that, you know. Now we go out and read some outside literature to find out really how to deal with the world. You know? So, that's the thing. It's so far above. It's for the postgraduates. So then, yeah. So then one may say, okay, we accept the Vedic literature as have everything. Then how are we going to get that? Because if Bhagavatam is a postgraduate, then how are we going to get from there? Right? One could say, okay, even we accept, but it's too over our heads, so we have to deal with something more up our alley, like, you know, just the karma books. But the point is that it's been written, all these things have been written so that we can approach them. So we can get something from them. And apply them. So Bhagavatam being the answer to all questions and all situations, then the idea is to study the Vedic literatures from that viewpoint so we see how Bhagavatam is the conclusion of that. So we know what are the elements of the other Vedic literatures, what they talk about, what is their sphere of subject matter, and how that conclusion is in Srimad Bhagavatam. Does this make some sense? So that's the whole approach, is approaching it with the idea is that the study of Bhagavatam should be that one appreciates and knows what are the other 14, you know, the other 13 books, or even the other 14, because even other transcendental literature, and how Bhagavatam is the essence of that. Essence meaning conclusions. Right? Because, as we were saying before, Mahabharata gives the essence of all the other literatures. What's the most important elements from each branch? What's the most important aspects of politics? What's the most important aspects of the histories? What's the most important aspects of, you know, your astrology or your Sanskrit or any of these things? What's the most important? but at the same time is only the end directly connects it to the Lord, the Gita. All the others are indirect. They may hint at it, they may even say it now and again, but it's in the midst of so much else that one may miss the point. Like if you have 30 verses on non-vegetarian, you know, diet, and two of them out of that 30 say that, you know, anybody with any brain wouldn't, you know, follow a non-vegetarian diet, what is the common person going to notice? 28 verses or the two? So that's the point. Out of 100,000, then, you know, 700 are definitely spiritual, and then another few hundred here and there are. So who's going to notice 1,000 verses in 100,000? Like that. So that's the point. Like our acharyas so many times quote from these Tamasic Puranas, that directly, just completely, you know, how you say, show that the path of anything other than pure bhakti is useless. But it's never taught. There's just one verse that doesn't quite make sense, but all these others do, so you stick to those and avoid that one. So those just happen to be the one that the acharyas pull out. You know? So then, but Vyasadeva wasn't satisfied, so Narada Muni explains, because you've given all the essence, but you haven't shown how that essence connects to the Lord. So you haven't actually shown people how to use that knowledge to go back to Godhead. Right? So then he wrote Srimad Bhagavatam, which then shows the conclusions of all that and how to go back to Godhead. So that's what makes the Bhagavatam special. So it actually really, it bridges the two and takes one beyond. That makes sense? Mm. So then this school, it means in the academy, then basically there's three levels of knowledge. There's the orientation, which makes, familiarizes us with the body of Vedic knowledge and its conclusions. Then the second level is that teaches us what is the, you know, the much of the detail of the Vedic literatures, you know, that are be basically useful for, you know, devotees and preachers like that. Not for someone who wants to specialize but in that field, but for those who want to have a, you know, a deeper understanding of what's going on in these literatures. Then the third level then is the actual study of the Bhagavatam. You know, and that level. The Bhagavatam and those books that go along with the Bhagavatam, that kind of study. You know, like Bhagavatam, Vedanta Sutra, the Tathagatasiddhantas, you know, other books of essence that the acharyas have given. Like Brahma Samhita, that's one of the books of essence. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvata, that was a book that his sannyasis used to read. Because it just gives conclusions.
Absolutely.
So, it means like that. So that's the third level. So, all these three then are the curriculum of the Sri Rupa Nupa Paramahati Vidyapi. But the Vidyapi is for those who live in the ashram. So the same body of knowledge then is made available then for those who don't live in the school, you know, come stay students through this Brahma Vidya Kshetra. So it's another one, another school. So that's what this is. Means this school then is studying the same thing that those who live in the school would study, but it's just the opportunity is given that I can study it by not having to live in the school. Like that. And then for the women, then that's taught through the Mangala Kshetra. So they can take those same academics, plus as ladies, then there's some subjects that they will study that the men won't. You know, like cooking and some other things like that. So that's basically what happens. So then the methods will be certain, material is given, that will be studied, and then that will be discussed. So what we're looking for when we study it, and then after studying it, then going through and discussing it, so it's clear what are the essences that we're looking for. What is the main principles that are getting across? What is it to be gained from it? Then that will be understood, and then you study that. So then you'll get more out of the classes. The difference between the three schools is that the men's school, then it'll rely more on the study that you've done. It means there'll be more that you, means you study it, then we discuss it. It means first you know what you're looking for when you study it, and then we discuss that afterwards. Does that make some sense? So we'll move through more matter quicker. Well, like in the Mangala Kshetra, the women prefer it more going through it together and going through these things. So they'll go through the same subject matter, but slower, like that. There'll be probably more discussion. And while the Rupa Nuga Paramarthic Vidyapeet means that they study these things along with their ashram practices, you know, brahmacharya ashram practices. So you get three different kinds of flavors in it. The same body of knowledge. Does that make any sense? Okay. Any questions?
How long will the course be?
Well, the actual course itself, if you take the whole thing, the last that we went through, it takes about 12 years.
Sure.
If you do everything that's available.
You planning to go through the whole thing?
Yeah. I'm saying is that's there. That's talking about the preliminary, the secondary, and the advanced courses. The advanced courses are about that 9. It means we have to finalize now if the primary and secondary are going to be 3 years or 2 years. Before it was done at 3 years. I mean, but now I think it would run at 2. Because I think we can get through it quicker. You know, that gives us more time for the advanced, because some of those areas need much more time.
We're doing the preliminary study now.
Yeah, this is the preliminary. In other words, orientating yourself to just understand the angle of vision of how the Vedic literatures work and all that. Because that's the first thing. It's a way of, just like you're going to the modern academy, then starting at MA, then they start teaching you how to think. How to observe, how to think like an academic, like that. But the Vedic system is you learn that from that's given basically at the time of the conception, and that anything that's taught is founded on that principle. So you always start from the essence and work back. How to think, how to approach it like this. So in recent times, that's kind of been lost. So there's people that no branches of knowledge, but don't actually understand their proper application or that. So that's a difficulty. You know, the actual thing is that you have to learn what is the essence of it. Certain things, you memorize the Vedic verses, you memorize the rituals, but to actually know if you have character, then they teach you the essence. So the principle is that essence is what needs to be learned. So the first thing is then how to think. Like there's methods of thinking.
That's logic.
And logic and just the frameworks within what it works. The modern is speculative. So you find that most schools is very hard to catch on to what they're thinking, because there's all these different elements that all work together when you apply it. And so then it becomes very difficult to understand what is the framework of it. But some people cook it down enough that you get a framework. Like you take Kavi. Why was Kavi so popular? Because he had a framework. He had 4 quadrants. Everything went back to those 4 quadrants. Or 7 habits. Right? So if you could count to 11, you know, and heck could remember that many things, then his system would work for him. You know? So that's the point. That's why it was so, you know, and then you go, oh, that's quadrant one, Prabhu, you know, I mean, you know, it would be, you know, that's, I mean, a few years ago, that's all you'd hear going on. Right? So then, that's, the, he gave a way of thinking, you know? Some of the, you know, four management principles, you know, and then somebody comes out with a fifth management principle, or, you know, different things like this. So you always have these kind of things. So the Vedic, there's already eternal frameworks that are established, and you simply have to understand them and think according to them. And when that's there, then things progress very nicely. Because you always have something that you can always relate everything back to. If you can do that, then any item, no matter how many there are, you have a smaller framework to put them all onto. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Let's say there's 100 items, but they all fit into, you know, 20 categories that actually are organized into, you know, three. You understand? So then it's just a matter of understanding, here's the major principles, you know, overarching principles, and then here's other major principles within those, and then everything else is details underneath those. So you always have something you can relate it back to. So it becomes, actually it makes the system very simple. So you can be very sophisticated, you can have a great amount of knowledge, but it's always consistent. That's the thing, is the Vedic paradigm is that it must be consistent. There can't be inconsistency. Mana also deals with that. He says that when you have two literatures that seem to be contradictory, they're not contradictory. They're all right. The difference is that they're applying to different persons in different time, place, and circumstance. You know, like that. Like you see Prabhupada, then Guru Kripa was going to go to South India, you know, because there were no temples in those days in South. It was an open field. So Guru Kripa went down there to travel in that for some time. So Prabhupada told him, just eat rice, you know, and, you know, these light, you know, these light vegetables and stuff that they cook. When Panchavibhuta was going to go south, he told him, only eat pukka food, which means fried, you know? Don't eat any uncooked foods. Uncooked meaning not cooked in ghee. Vedic, you know, that's called raw food. Uncooked means not cooked in ghee, and cooked means cooked in ghee. Like that, or that's pakka or kacha, like that. So then one would think this is a contradiction. But the difficulty was Guru Kripa had a bad stomach. He had a sensitive stomach. So if he ate anything other than just rice and, you know, yogurt and some simple things, and he'd get sick, he wouldn't be able to do a service. Right? So better he was healthy and could do a service. Panchavibhuta, he had a, you know, very strong digestion, that he needed to eat anything. So Prabhupada told him only eat pukka food, because kacha food carries karma, while pukka food doesn't. Right? So the principle is what is best for the person to do a service, what will maintain their health. So because the one's physical health was all right, then he would worry about then what will his spiritual health, right? By not taking on the karma. But in the other case, is because his physical health was bad, if it got worse, then he wouldn't do any service, which would be the worst for his spiritual life. So the best thing for his spiritual life is to be engaged, even though you may be taking on some karma in doing that, taking on other people's karma by eating their food. Does that make sense? Like that. So then, you see, there's, even though they seem to be contradictory, they're not, they're consistent, because the person's engagement in devotional service is the common principle. But now, what will work best for one person, what will work best for the other? That's what has to be seen. So in the Vedic literatures, there's no contradiction. You know? In other words, certain principles are there. You must accept authority. So you must accept, you must approach Guru. You know, you must, how do you say, you must be active. Right? Activity is useful, non-activity is not useful. You must be clean, you must be regulated. Right? There must be some form of respect, I mean some form of, you know, practical form of respect that's offered to those who are respectable. Does that make some sense? These are principles that have to be there. You have to have some knowledge. What you're doing must be based on knowledge. So then, but now you have people who are interested in transcendence, people who, you know, going, it means Vaishnav. You have those who are interested in transcendence with the Brahman. You have those who are interested in enjoying in the material world, but not here, but in the heavenly planets. You want those who want to enjoy here, but in the pious way, or refined way. You have those who want to enjoy, but in what would technically be normally considered as sinful. So then the scriptures are written so that these principles are there for everybody. So even the gross materialist, then it's like, okay, you want to enjoy, then you have to give in charity, you know, to get more wealth. You want more wealth, so you have to give in charity. And if you just give to any old people, then you only get back how much you give. But you give to qualified people, then you get back, you know, multifold. Or you go to heavenly planets, and if you do this, you go to this heavenly planet. You do that, you go to that heavenly planet. So to do all that, you have to be initiated, you have to approach guru, you have to perform sacrifice, you have to be austere, you have to respect your authorities, you have to be clean to do your rituals. You know, and it all has to be based on the scriptures. So guru, sadhu, and shastra is put into place, but he's doing it simply to go to the heavenly planets. Does that make sense? But at least he's following those principles. So that if he does come in contact with someone who is bona fide and can teach him spiritual life, then all the principles of spiritual life are already in place. Now all it is that you replace the Karmakanda guru with the transcendental. Like you see Maharaj Prachinda Barhishad. He was already austere, already did great sacrifice, already had faith in the Brahmins, already had faith in the Vedic literature. Like this. So already was pious and virtuous. But his gurus just taught him about Karmakanda. So when Narad Muni came and explained to him, you know, this story of Puranjana, then he understood, oh, okay, so how come my gurus never told me about this? So Narad Muni said to Karmakanda, they don't know that there's something beyond this. So they taught you what they thought was the best. But there's beyond Karmakanda. Does this make some sense? You know, there's beyond. So so that's the principle, is that they're all engaged. So then for him, very easy to just take up the devotional process, because all the elements of the process he's been following his whole life. But he just didn't have the right conclusion. Right? He's already giving in charity this step. Now it changes to why he's doing it. He's not doing it to go to the heavenly planets. Now he's doing it to go back to Godhead.
It's like that sannyasi from Jaladharma. And he was like doing everything perfectly, but he had the wrong conclusion.
But at the same time, for him to follow the lifestyle of the Vaishnavas was very easy, because he was used to sadhana, used to renunciation, used to detachment, you know. But he just had to get used to, you know, that a person was at the end of the line, and that you could do activities, you know, that engaged, you know, the mind and the senses in that person's service, while the impersonalists, they don't have that option. You know, they work in an emotionless, senseless field. You know, it's only intellectual. So it's very difficult, because the intelligence is actually connected to the senses.
So for someone like that, who was so fixed up in his sadhana and everything, and then, but it's an unnatural state to withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
So then would that have even been easier for him, because then he was performing things which were natural to him? You know, like, you know, the devotional kind of sadhana.
Basically, it would be easier if he has that faith. But otherwise, then sometimes you see the easiest thing, which is the most natural and most obvious, sometimes people can't do because they don't have the faith in it. So if he has that faith, then yes, it is the best. But if he doesn't have that faith, then it's a bit of a problem. Yeah, then it'll be a bit of a problem. Because actually, if you could do it easy, it's easier than what he is doing. But it's just getting the faith to be able to do it.
Then you can trust that person.
Yeah, that's the thing. Because generally what happens is that they don't believe that it's so easy, like that Gopal Chapla. You know, very well read, learned Brahmin, but he was just a nihilist. He was an impersonalist. You know? So he couldn't believe that it's so difficult to get to the platform of liberation. He couldn't believe that just by chanting the holy name in an impure state, you've already attained liberation. You know, because anybody could do that. You know, here it's only by great grammar and other things like that that they're able to do something. So he couldn't appreciate. He couldn't appreciate it. That was the difficulty. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yes. That was his problem.
Sometimes also people think that in order to become a spiritual advisor that you have to do something different you are doing in your material life. Once Janina was probably told me a story about one pujari, and he was working before he became a devotee in one sweet shop. So he was a very excellent sweet maker. So then he, you know, he came to Mayapur and they wanted him to make sweets for the deities, but he just couldn't do it because he was doing all his life and was, you know,
he's spiritual, he's different.
Yeah, something. So yeah. They couldn't get him to do sweets.
Yeah, yeah. I remember. Yeah, he was. Their family ran the sweet shop, so he knew perfectly how to make all these, you know, in Calcutta. So they weren't
pretty good.
Yeah, but he just couldn't do it. He hated making sweets because spiritual license would chant and, you know, bhajan and, you know, stuff like that. You know. Yeah, I remember.
About the faith, where does that come from? Since living entities have different degrees of faith or place their faith in different things, so originally, why some living entities, where does it come from, the faith?
Faith is by the grace of the Lord. Because we see, as Krishna in Gita mentions, that when someone takes up the worship of the demigods and all that, and Krishna gives them faith to be able to do that. Because otherwise, how do you have? How do you focus?
So it comes from the desire.
Yeah. When you desire, then it will come. If you don't desire, it won't come. That's, Krishna is very clever like that. You know? It means, if one doesn't want to find it, Krishna will provide it. He'll provide for you, you know, loopholes and faults that you can find either in the devotees or in the process. You know, you'll perceive it like that. It's not actually there. But he'll organize it in such a way that you will see it like that. And so then, because of that, then you will then fall away from the process and have doubts in it, or go somewhere else, or, you know, like that, because it can easily be seen. You know, one can say, no, it's actually a fault, but people find fault in God, in Krishna. You know, he didn't organize things properly, otherwise why is things going wrong? You know, I heard some of the devotees say that, You know, why didn't Krishna just make us so we follow? Why did he make us so that we have this choice that we make a mistake? You know, it's like it's his fault.
But that basically means he would have to force people to be good. Then they would complain about that. Oh, you forced me.
Yeah, that's the point. It's just spin doctrine. That's and they're only saying that because something's going wrong for them. If things are going right,
yeah.
There's one story, I don't remember exactly in which Veda, but it describes how the Ashrada or lack of faith was born. So then there was those ritualistic Brahmas who were performing different rituals to elevate themselves to heavenly planets. So as a part of this, of the ritual was that they were using that sacrificial knife, spear, to slay the enemy of the sacrifice in the northern direction, and after that there was a little achana to purify the hands because they were stained with the blood. So one time they were performing the sacrifice and they forgot to do that achana, so their hands were impure, and as a result of that then they didn't get the results they desired, and then they lost their faith. So then they, you know, then the demigods had to make an arrangement to then Vibhu Muni came and he was preaching to them and he made them faithful again, but like that because of the desire to gain something, and then
then when it doesn't happen,
then they
it's karma kind, it's actually Jnani's philosophy. So we hear devotees go, you know, I've done the ritual, I've done the thing, you know, I did the sankirtan, I surrendered, I did it, where's my result?
Yeah.
That's Jnani.
Yeah.
That's not Vaishnava.
It's not Bhakti.
Yeah. You know, but, you know, so that's the thing. And if you say, oh, you mean you all those years of sankirtan, you did those just for a result, so you get some recognition and a place to stay and some, you know, like that, you'll say no. And they say, so then what are you worried about? No, but, you know, I'm senior, I've been around, so I've done so much service, so why don't I have, you know, just like that. So intellectually they know it's wrong, but their mind still sticks to it. So it's a lack of faith, you know, because that's the principle, is that ritual or religion should give me economic profit. I should gain from it. Otherwise, what's the use of religion, right? So it's business. So that's why Prabhupada always says we don't do business with God. You know? All these little things he says, it's because these are the mentalities that can come up.
It's a whole misconception, because like this, then you think that you are God, because everything is in control. You perform the ritual and then you should get the results. Mm-hmm. So then it's a misconception of what actually the Absolute is, because proper understanding is that God is he is the control and he is the provider, and then you act accordingly. So then,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it also means that the faith is based on the result, that you get the result, and when you don't get the result, you lose your faith.
Mm-hmm. That's why many times.
But that's not like real faith.
No, it's not. That's why many times you see a person sincere, then they perform, then they get really wonderful results. Then they get faith. But someone who doesn't want actually to get faith, then they won't get results. And so then they don't get that faith.
Yeah.
But at some point, Krishna is going to test if the faith is there, whether something's going to mesh or not. You know.
Yeah.
Like that. So that's always there, because it has to see, is it real? Krishna goes away from the gopis, he leaves the rasa dance, but they don't lose their faith in him. He goes, hey, you know, we went out before, you know, we left our homes, left everything, this guy dumped us, oh, oh, oh. Get him. You know, we walk off, go back to the place.
Curse Krishna and then God's there.
Yeah, go down to the spa. You know, what do we need these guys for?
Is it proper to say that in such an example of gopis, when you know they completely unmotivated and they give everything to Krishna, so but still they get something from Krishna, so there is always exchange.
It's always exchange, but they don't see it like that. If you are looking at the exchange, then that takes it back to the queens of Dwarka. There's 50-50. Swakya means is 50% of their desires fulfilled, and 50% they fulfill the desire of the husband. So that's Swakya.
And what Parakya was there?
Parakya is 100% just to please Krishna.
Oh.
That's why it's considered higher.
Right. That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
So even the queens at Dwarka, they want something.
Yeah, because naturally, as wives, it's just, you know, their right to, you know, enjoy certain facilities and certain interactions. You know, you can just say it's a natural right women have to get be given facility and time by men, by their husbands. If they don't, if the husband doesn't give them facility and give them time, no one will say that they're a good husband.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, and if you say that, you know, the wife
you know, well, you know, my wife wants some place to stay, you know, instead of, and she expects me to, you know, talk to her now and again. I'm like, oh, hey, hello, you know,
you're married,
like that. And so then, you know, he said to have it to hold, and didn't say anything about, you know, a house. You know, so like that. So it's just, that's just the way it is. That's the rasa. The parakia then works on a different level. There it's just complete surrender. You know, you see in the material world anyway. Also in the parakia, then the sensitivity of each is so much, is so great that they'll just do anything for the other party. But as soon as that becomes formalized, either as marriage or de facto, then all that goes and it switches into the swakya.
Mm.
You know, then they expect what they want. Now it's payback time.
Yeah.
You know, like that. So that's the thing. It's just surrender. It's just so much greater. The surrender is so much greater.
Must be even like more so because, from what I understand, the gopis were married as well, so they're involved in swakya, mm-hmm. but they still.
Yeah.
Like just, you know, totally kind of.
Yeah. No, it's the most. Because the surrender is only for the Lord's pleasure, it's not for their own. Mm-hmm. So that's what's being offered by Lord Chaitanya. Just how to come to that platform where you don't want anything. You know? You only want Krishna's pleasure.
Mm-hmm. So it's still there is this desire, some motivation is there.
Motivation is to please Krishna. Motivation is not the problem. It's what is the purpose of that motivation. Because motivation means you're dealing with a living entity, and you're dealing with them interacting with another living entity, so you're dealing with rasa there. But the point is the motive is to please Krishna. You know, and therefore the method used is to please Krishna. And the relationship is seen in relationship to Krishna. Right? So, since you see yourself as servant of Krishna, that his pleasure is your goal, and so then you'll use methods that please him to accomplish that, and that's considered glorious.
Is it possible to say in this progression from Shraddha to Prema, at which point that this selfishness goes away in the motivation?
Nishtha, basically. That's where you see the major.
When you become fixed.
Yeah. Then you'll see. That's when, like, basically the gross is done. And the subtle is being worked on. And at Ruchi, then the subtle goes. You know, Dhanam Janam Sundarin, that goes in Ruchi.
But say, like, you know, me, I'm battling with these gross desires, so then when I'm over those, can I then look forward to take on all the subtle things? Do I have to do that?
That's easy enough.
Like the subtle sex?
Yeah, but I'm saying that's a matter of that, but that is taken on by intelligence. Like, what's the use of it?
So it's not that you know, you go through the gross things and you overcome those, and then you have to go through.
No, you have to. That's there because we've come here for that. So we have to give those up. But it's battling on a different platform. Because it's subtle, therefore the battle is subtle also. The other is gross, so it's more. But the point is it's just like, you have, okay, one's attracted to sex life. Okay, so then one gets that in control, gets that regulated and all these different things. But then, or we get it done, okay, you know, we can give up, you know, sex life as it be celibate.
Yeah.
Okay. Then there's the principle of sex life itself. You understand?
To give that up.
Yeah. That principle. So that's what you deal with in the settlement. You
know. Because it manifests in the desire for recognition and prestige and stuff like that.
So that all has to go. So the basically gross of that means the bulk of that is then taken care of by Ruchi. Because you have a higher taste and then there's no need for these things.
Right.
There's some subtlety that's still there that needs to go, and that will go with time and association. You know, just that I am the, you know, the controller, enjoyer, or that I am a great devotee. I am a great devotee, or I am the, I am advanced. You know, like that. And those are the subtleties of the same thing. You know, I am the guru of Vaishnavas, or I am advanced. You know, because guru Vaishnavas, you know, will be in interaction. You're the senior, they're the junior. You know, you're kind to them, merciful to them, and all these different things. And then I am advanced, and that's your position. So those are the last two of that line that must be given up. So the sooner one works on that, you know, that's why humility is taken as the key.
But they can be worked on together.
They're all worked on together, but sometimes each individual will work maybe in one area more than another, and then another devotee works in another area. So by that sadhu sangha, then you get the benefit of their, you know, contemplation, like it's an area they've been thinking about for years, like you take, you know, Sachinanda Maharaj, you know, and chanting, you know. So then from that, he's thought so much, studied so much, and then he'll come out with a book on it, you know, and then whenever he gives lecture, we'll discuss that. So you get the benefits of that, though maybe you've been thinking of another area. And so then, you know, each devotee then has their
expertise.
Yeah, like that. And so then in that way, by that sankirtan, by that complete kirtan, that association, then, you know, everybody gets benefit from each other.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Maharaj, you, in one of your recent lectures, you said that the Jainese philosophy can defeat all others. So
all others below him.
Below him.
Yeah, not above him.
So could you elaborate it?
No, that comes in another course.
Okay.
In the six systems, when that comes along, and that the Dharma is there. Because basically, he doesn't. The independent nature of God is not accepted, but defeating all the, you know, atomic theory and logic and all those things, and he does that.
Which one is Jaimini's?
Jaimini's Karma Mimosa.
Karma.
So that's called Purva Mimosa. That's why it's so powerful. Purva means it's based on the first two parts of the Veda. The Samhita and the Brahmanas, that's the first. Uttara Mimamsa means what's later, so the Aranyakas and the Upanishads. So that's Vedanta. Because the Aranyakas deal with the esoterics, or the metaphysics of what's going on, why they're going on. And the Upanishads is the philosophy, transcendence. So that's Uttara Mimamsa, so that's higher than Purva. Like that. So that's the sixth system.
I heard from Bhaktivedanta Maharaj's seminar that one of followers of Jaimini, I think Kumarilabhata, something like that.
Kumarilabhata.
Kumarilabhata. He actually defeated Buddhist philosophy in India.
Yeah, because it's non-Vedic, so you can always defeat Vedic, non-Vedic or Vedic.
So by using the Karma Mimamsa's philosophy.
Yeah, you could do that. There would be also our other acharyas, Ramanuja and Madhva, and they would also defeat Buddhists and Jains. Mm-hmm. Like that. Using Vaishnava, using Uttara Mimamsa. Like that. And just there's certain things that you use, and they just always, because everybody accepts certain elements of all of them. Because they're all based on Veda, just the conclusions go wrong. Like that. So just like the system of logic, everybody accepts Nyaya, but not as conclusion, but as a method of discussion, all the six schools accept it. But for those who call it follow Vaisheshika, then that is their method to understand everything, analyze everything, and come to conclusion on everything. So it's that's it for them. That's all there is.
there is only the atoms and how they've been put together. So all they do is analyze the material universe. So they don't go beyond.
That's basically like the modern science.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's why if you know these, then you understand the elements by which everybody's working. You won't find someone who's a pure, you know, Jaimini scholar, a pure, you know, Vaishya seeker, a Patanjali, or this or that. You know, even in the Vedic, it's very rare to find somebody nowadays. Let alone in the Western. In the Western, there'll just be elements here and there out of all these, but if you understand the principles that they're all based on, then you'll understand, you know, this person is saying this point is from here and that point's from there. That's why you always have a system. That's why six systems of philosophy, they have a framework on which you can hang everything. So each one of them have a framework, but there's some faults in it because it's speculative. So only Vyas is actually real. His framework is real. So because of that, it can defeat all the other frameworks. Because there will be contradictions in their philosophies that they can't deal with. Because it's being done for a particular purpose, then they don't, it's not important to them, they don't notice it, they don't see the problem.
So are the Shad Darshana, the Vedanta Sutra is the superior one?
Yeah. And within Vedanta, then the Vaishnav in understanding is superior than the impersonal understanding. Yeah. And then of the Vaishnava systems, then we follow the Chintamaya Vedanta.
Right.
Like that. So within Vedanta, within Uttara Mimamsa, you have six schools.
Again.
Yeah. Like that. They're the six schools, so the top of that is Uttara Mimamsa, which is considered Vyasadeva. You know? But still there's six schools of that. So Shankara is one of them. You know, and then you have the four sampradayas. Then you have Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Then you have Govinda Basu. So like that. So even with Vedanta, it depends how you interpret it and where you go. So Shankara interprets it, you get to Brahman. The other Vaishnavacharyas interpret it, then you get to Vaikuntha. You know, or some to Nimbarka, you get to Baloka. But to get to Braj, then only Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gives that.
Which Sampradaya is Nimbarka in the Kumara?
I think he is, yeah, I think he's the Kumara. Yeah. Yeah, the Kumara.
In which book Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes meetings of Lord Chaitanya, his different acharyas, from, you know, leaders of different sampradayas?
That's in the Navadvipa Dhamma.
Do they accept it? Members of those
sampradayas? Doesn't matter. We don't care. They accept it or not. It's mentioned in the Bhavishya Purana, so he's not just making it up. It's in the Bhavishya Purana. So they may accept, may not accept. It's not important for us. Yeah.
Do you have that here in the library? The Bhavishya Purana?
But it's in Sanskrit. That's the slight difficulty.
Are there any interesting predictions that we don't know about?
I don't know, because it hasn't been translated. Only heard of parts here and there. Some people do a few things, they translate a few things here and there, but no one has done them all.
Is it true that they predict Jesus? Somebody said that.
Yeah, it talks about him, it talks about, you know, all the acharyas, it even talks about Akbar and Birbal.
Really?
Yeah, Sutta and that one.
For
real? Yeah, very, very special. So
So that means if it was interpolated, it had to have been done by the Gaudiya Vaishnava. They mentioned Sarvabhauma Vakacharya.
I visited one website of one ex ISKCON devotee who claims to be a great scholar in Shastras, and he translates different books. So he wrote one article about three books written by our previous teachers. It's Prema Virata by Jagadananda, and Navadvipa Shataka, and one more. Anyway, so he writes that actually those books, which have been found by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, but actually they have been written by himself, by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And he gives detailed explanation.
You can detail anything. And if people have so many books and so many things, what do we care? That's why it's not worth getting involved so much. People have their opinions, what do we care?
So I can't
bear
to think we came out of the ocean
and
made
it.
Yeah.
I mean,
what does it matter?
Like those books have been written in that Bengali language of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's time.
The point is this.
Chaitanya Chintamani.
What's the problem? Because the thing is because they're simply academics, the door is closed for them. You know, Lord Chaitanya tells Maya Devi that now that his mission is starting, now she can remove the coverings on the bhakti literatures and the verses that point out the Sankirtan mission and all these things. So how will somebody by their intellect actually be able to understand? You know? Because they are looking at Bengali as something by time and space, and the acharyas as time and space, and looking at it through the angle of mundane truth. How they'll ever have entrance? Never. Now you're going to tell me that the acharyas that live in the spiritual world, and that's where Bengali's from, right? Navadvip there, and Svetadvip and Goloka. That's where they speak Bengali. Right? And so that Bengali then is spoken by the Lord and his associates. And you're going to tell me that there's not going to be some similarity in their style of language? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of things would immediately be rejected by such persons. They don't have that kind of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And even, so what? Even if he did write it, even if he did, so what?
Mm-hmm.
You have somebody coming down from the spiritual world telling you how it is, but he doesn't want to say, I'm saying, so he's saying others are saying. You know, so he maintains this, you know, the etiquette of this humility. At the same time, this conclusion must be spoken, so therefore he does. What's the loss? You know, why would one even spend one's time to prove that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, what he said, was wrong? Why would anybody who had any interest in pleasing the Lord and his devotees take that as a topic for his essays? So that means this person isn't interested in that. And if he's not interested in that, why would anybody have any interest in him? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Just like this. Some years back, we were doing a lot of research in the Indian classical music sphere. And when I go to these, I mean, we go to top musicians, you know. And because we had a lot of questions, and technical questions and all that, and they would ask, where did you get that from? We quote some book, and they all laugh. Because so many academics come and may do their PhDs and other things on Indian classical music, but they wouldn't be able to play one note of it. So they actually have no idea what is raga, what is the music, how it works. They just don't know. But they can put together things, and this raga is, you know, done at this time of the day, and, you know, in this book it's mentioned this, and that authority says that, and, you know, it sounds very good, and they get a degree for it. And they may be the expert on North Indian classical music, but as far as playing it, you know, one guy has made a whole paper on where Sa was for so many people. And how, you know, this one was using, you know, 400, you know, megahertz, and this one was using 370, and this one is using this, and this one is using that. So the showing is that they don't have a standard. Well, in Western, you know, C means this. It doesn't matter where in the world, they all use the same exact note. But for the Indian, it's the intervals that make the difference. So you can put your Sa way down if you want, as long as your intervals are right. But that was the thing, is they saw all their intervals are perfect. But just where they would start would be different. So what? Right? Any musician would just say, wherever he starts, Sa. I see musicians, they just start. They just pick up their sitar, because they don't want to sit there and tune it for hours. They see what are the main notes that are still in tune and tune everything else around that and then play. If they're doing a lesson, they don't care. It doesn't matter if they're working, you know, here at C sharp, or they're working at C, or they're working at... They know their instrument will sound best at a particular thing, but they're just teaching you a lesson. So they're not going to spend 45 minutes tuning their sitar for you to learn Sa Re Ga Ma Pa Da Ni. You're not going to do that. But when they play the intervals, their frets are perfect. They'll readjust their frets. They'll do everything to make it perfect. But they won't bother where you start. It doesn't matter.
Makes it much more dynamic.
Yeah, so it always works. You know, that's the thing. You know? So they can teach you on any platform. So that's the thing. Is someone who's expert works at that. So they figure those who are the academics in the field, they don't know what they're talking about. Like you look at these academic books, you have Jatis, which is the original ragas. Those are gone long ago. And Prabandhas, those also disappeared thousands of years ago. Then they had the Raga Raginis, and those are also gone. So the only thing left is where Bhatkhande went and collected all these ragas from all over India, and then categorized them into something that seemed to make some sense, that they kind of worked on this group of notes, and that one on this group of notes, and this on this group of notes. So this way he made, I think, 10 tats. But the tat itself is not a raga, but within that there are ragas. It's just a grouping of notes. Like that. So, and that's accepted what's going on. So what Bharat Muni's talking about, this and that, has died a long time ago, and even your modern musicians can't tell you what it means. But, you know, but they know that what the academics are talking about is even less true. You know? You know what I'm saying? But you find people that still follow those jots and all those different systems that are all there, is that the academics and everybody says is dead. Just because they come in a parampara, it still follows that. You know, but they're doing it to please the Lord, they're not doing it to make money, therefore who hears about it? So that's the point, is that unless it's connected to the Lord, it's just all speculation. But that doesn't matter how academic or how intellectual they are. Rabindra Swarup would always joke that you know, they're, you know, down there in Boston, you have these professors that they, you know, there's those that they specialize in Gaudiya Vaishnava literature. They're not devotees. So he's saying they sit there and they're discussing some technical grammatical point that, you know, Jiva Goswami is making in the, you know, Bhakti Sandarbha, you know, over a beer down at the pub, you know. like that. You know, I do think Jiva meant this by that, or, you know, so they mentioned that he said this. What do you think? Well, I don't know. You know, it can be this and that. And this one, then he used it like this and that. You know, things just go on and on.
Is this one something to have something to talk about?
Yeah, just something to engage your intellect. So it's there, it's nice, you know, it's all it is. You know, it's just like, you know, we had that one book, you know, it's got 50 chapters to prove that, you know, you can't fall from the spiritual world. 50 chapters. But our Acharya said we fell from the spiritual world. So why would you even make such an endeavor? Why would you make an endeavor to oppose something the Acharya says? So you even have to say that you know more than him and he's made a mistake. Or you have to be, you know, how you say, very determined not to go back to Godhead. You know, there has to be some motive. You know? So this is the problem you have. So finding people that are willing to give their own opinion and prove that one of the Acharyas is wrong, that's not such a rare thing. And it's nothing glorious. You know, do you think that Lord Chaitanya is going to accept their jnana over the Acharya's bhakti? Besides that, do you really think that they have the jnana that these Acharyas have? I remember, I think it was Panchavibha was telling me, they were on a train ride. I forget where they were riding from. You know, either, you know, one of these long, either Vrindavan, Calcutta, or Calcutta, or Vrindavan, Bombay, I think it was one of those, you know. Or sometimes they go Bombay, Calcutta. You know, so any of these, they're long train rides. And so one day, Prabhupada just started talking. His devotees, you know, there was Prabhupada's compartment, and then there was the others, all devotees around, so anyone could come into Prabhupada's compartment. He just spoke 12 hours straight on philosophy. Nobody could sit the whole time. He just did it to show that, you know, we can talk about Krishna all day. There's no limit. There's no end. You know, so it's not that, you know, we just do, you know, we only talk, you know, 20 minutes for the class and that's it. We can go on all day. It's just that you can only handle 20 minutes. That's why we stop there. In 12 hours he spoke. You know, somebody made the comment, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is, oh, you know, you're, you spoke on that verse, or we've heard that verse before, the first verse of Bhagavatam, you know, so many times. You know, speak on something else, more, you know, esoteric, more. So he wanted to show that you could speak on that verse every day and never say the same thing. So he spoke for 90 days. Each time he took a different topic that was out of the verse. You know, or Lord Chaitanya spoke on the Atmarama verse. You know, 64 different explanations out of one verse. You know? So that's the point, is that the Acharya speaks so that we can understand. Otherwise we don't understand what's easy. They have no need to come here and show their prowess. You know? And just like we see is that Satchimata then defeated Lord Chaitanya on impersonal philosophy. She's just a housewife. So the residents of the spiritual world would have no problem defeating the greatest scholar, you know, on these points. Mother Shoda could argue with anybody in the universe and defeat her. You know, but she has better things to do, like, you know, Nimai's lunch, you know. It's much more important. So intellectual prowess, it has some meaning here because we give value to it. You know, just like rupees, they're just pieces of paper, or dollars, they're all just pieces of paper that don't have any more value than the piece of paper they're written on. You know? So that's it, but because everyone attributes, you come up with that particular piece of paper, then they'll trade you goods for it. Right? So everybody agrees, so it works. So, because people think that prestige for intellectual prowess is that is of value, therefore it's accepted. Therefore the Acharyas will deal with it. But as far as what they, how far they can go, how can somebody who's conditioned understand the viewpoint of somebody who's not conditioned? Right? Madhvacharya, they were going through the Vishnu Sahasranam. That's a very major thing for those, you know, the Vaikuntha Sampradayas. He gave 40 different means translations of each name. You know, he went through each one. You know, he went through the whole thing, gave one, went back again, did again, went through back again. So 40 times went through the whole Vishnu Sahasranam, each time giving a different thing. At 40, then the disciples said, "That's it, we can't handle it anymore." He was planning to do 108. You know, and now he could go more. It's unlimited, but you know, he thought 108 was a nice number, but at 40, they just couldn't handle it. You know? So, you know, these things are, you know, who you're dealing with. You know, he would talk with six people at once. It means he would dictate six different books at the same time. He'd have six writers there. He'd say the first verse to the first one, then the first verse of the second book to the second person, the first verse of the third book to the third person, like this. By the time he did the sixth, the first person's ink was dry, so then he spoke the next one to him. That's why he kept six, because then he could always keep on. And then he's just going through, that means he's keeping six full books in his head. You know, because they just speak them, they're already finished literatures. You know what I'm saying? It's not that they write it and that's the rough draft and then go back through and rewrite it and then do it again and then get, you know, writer's block and then, you know, have it lead it a few days and then come back and then have a friend then give it to the editor and then discuss with them and then do the final edit. No, they just speak already finished literatures. Right? And so then one would be, it would not be an intelligent thing to do to find that kind of fault. Mm. Who cares? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's just a waste of time. They're wasting their time and they're wasting everybody else's time.
But, I mean, for personal understanding, we can just have such a conclusion regarding those people. But for the sake of benefit of whole society...
I would say exactly the same thing, what I just said. First, he has to prove that his paper even has any value that it's worth discussing. You know, first there has to be, like, you want to bring something up to a court, there has to be plain face to you. It has to first show that it even is something worth considering by the court. So it's like, you know what I'm saying? So what's it based on? On what Acharya's works, on what things is it based on? That he could claim that his paper has any value. Mm-hmm. Nothing. It's based on modern academic critical, you know,
approach.
Yeah, that's all. The critical means that they don't have faith in the subject matter that they're writing about, but they have 100% faith in their own judgment. Mm-hmm. So it's absolutely subjective. This whole thing that modern academics is objective is complete nonsense. It's the most subjective because it's not even based on any scriptural thing. It's just their own interpretation. Or the interpretation of the teacher that they have to write their paper for. That's it. It's not objective. No, they shouldn't fool themselves. No one else should be fooled by them. Modern academics is the least objective thing. Mm-hmm. Like that. Though that's their claim. But absolutely not. It's just pure speculation.
And they're close-minded too.
Very close-minded. They interpret it all, and they all interpret it the same way. So you can see it's each one, it's each you know, armchair speculator. They all think it the same. They have to, otherwise they won't become PhDs. And if they want their paper to be accepted and come in journals, then they have to write close enough to the paradigm that everybody will accept it. You can come up with a new interpretation that everybody else will shoot down, and you'll do okay. But otherwise, you come up with two different of an angle, you're shot right down because these other guys are sitting in the seat. You know, until you become sit on top, then you can't do anything about it, right? You know, you do your PhD in your early 20s, but the guy sitting in the chair is in his 50s or 60s. Right? So that means you have to wait till the guy croaks. And most likely you're not going to be the next one in the chair. There's going to be someone in between. Right? So then you've got to wait until you're 50, 60, then you're sitting in the chair. Now are you going to contradict everything you've been saying for the last 30, 40 years? And say that that was all wrong, actually it was a political maneuver, but actually I think like this. Do you think anyone's going to take you as a real academic? No. So where's the objectivity? It's not. It's just made up. They just pat each other on the back and say, this is great. You know, and if somebody says, well, you're doing the same thing, then say, fine. At the time of death, we'll find out who's patting who on the back. That's what Prabhupada told that academic in Russia. You know. He said, well, you have faith in that, I have faith in this. And Prabhupada said, yes. At the time of death, we'll find out whose faith is actually right. So that's the point. Okay, we should have it. So that means that on Friday, then we'll have some stuff printed out for you and everything that we want to read and all that.
So it's going
to
be Mondays and Fridays?
Mondays and Fridays, yeah. Because Tuesdays and Thursdays, then the ladies have.
Great.
You know, it's similar. Work. You know, as time goes, there'll be more to look at. You know, there'll be more stuff, but in the beginning we're a little slower because we have to understand what we're dealing with. You know, so the first thing we'll do is go through, because Manu is one of the ones that's finished, so first thing we'll go through the actual table of contents, you know, which is about, I think the full thing's about, well, the new one, it may be a little bit less, but it's around 30 pages. That's the table of contents.
Pretty big book.
That, but it's just elaborate. It means by reading the table of contents, you can actually understand the book.
Okay, yeah.
So that would be the first thing. Then after that, then we go through the essential verses, which is about 60, 70 pages, you know, of the whole work. And then the third time we go through would be then about 300 pages. Like that. So that's the plan how the course would go. Means the first two are actually part of the orientation course, but unless other things are ready for that, then we'll move on to other aspects. But if they're not, then we'll just go to the third level. Because the point is it gets done in the end, you know, if to get the degrees from the academy, then the work has to have been done. Like that. So all this study will go forward towards degrees, you know, like that. So then, if you want to, you know, if to go towards that, then this submission, you would have the forms that you just fill up and register as a student of the academy.
How do I know?
Huh?
Yeah, I think we should do that.
Yeah. And then, like that. The ladies' school, they all registered. Many have registered, not all of them.
And we are going through Manu Samhita book or also other books belonging to Dharma Shastras?
Maybe we'll go through Manu. Only if someone was specialized in Dharma Shastras, then we'll go through others. But right now we'll go through Manu. Because Manu is the original. All of those are based on Manu. Because Manu means Krishna speaks to Brahma, Brahma speaks to Bhrigu, and Bhrigu then speaks that to us. That's what Manu Samhita is.
Is that Bhrigu speaking?
Manu Samhita is Bhrigu speaking. Because Manu is Brahma.
In that millennium?
No, it's just, this is, you know, this goes back to the, you know, or the original.
So it's not one of these Manus that changes.
Means those teachings are given to us by Manu. Means by, for us, means it's coming down through Vaivasvata Manu.
Right.
You know.
But he's not the speaker.
No, he's not the speaker, but those teachings will come to us through him. Okay.
So you can say Manu means him, like that. But at the same time as that, Manu here means Brahma. But Brahma says Manu actually means Krishna. Mm. Because it's Swayambhu. A Swayambhu. Yeah, Swayambhu. So Krishna is actually Swayambhu. So then Brahma is coming from him. But because he's not born in the normal way, the woman, he's called unborn. So therefore he's known as Swayambhu. And then you have Swayambhu Manu. He's of all the Manus, then Swayambhu is the head. Like that. So it can refer to any of them.
Okay.
But the book itself is the sages questioning Lord Brahma about Dharma Shastra in connection to the Lord. So, you know, because they know the Dharma Shastra, but they want to know it in connection to the Lord, and they say only Brahma knows that. So the Brahma says that he introduces and shows us direct connection. And then he says, for the laws themselves, Bhrigu will speak now. Like that. So then Bhrigu speaks the rest of the book. So half of the first chapter is spoken by Brahma, and then the rest of the book is spoken by Bhrigu himself. Like that. And I think only once. I think only once when the sages question him.
Hmm.
They ask a question to him.
To Manu?
No, to Bhrigu. They ask a question to Manu in the beginning. And then he then spoke the first half of the first chapter. Then for details he hands that over to Bhrigu. And then you see is because he says he spoke to all his 10 sons this knowledge. So then in Bhagavatam, then we get the same knowledge coming down to Narada. But Narada is speaking to Yudhishthira as a devotee, and you know that particular conversation is then meant for the Vaishnavas. But what Bhrigu is speaking is for everybody.
Hmm.
Like that. But it's the same body of knowledge. If you understand Dharma Shastra, you see how that's the point. It's whatever there is in Dharma Shastra, it's already there. You know, just like whatever is of essence, of importance, of the Mahabharata, it's in the first canto. You know, it's sun's in the 10th canto. You know, so, you know, whatever is there of importance in the, you know, the creation and all the major stories and the Puranas, it's all in the Bhagavata. Because they're always happening again and again and again, all these stories. There's, is it 28? I think there's 28 avatars or something that appear every day in Brahma's day. Like that. So that means every day they're all performing the pastimes. So then, because that's major, then generally when there's a discussion, those 28 will always come up in the conversations. But depending upon which day you're talking about, there might be some slight difference. Therefore, you see a difference between the Bhagavatam's explanation in one pastime and the Mahabharata's explanation. You might find it in another Purana, maybe even different again. But all it is just cultivated different days of Brahma. That's all. But otherwise, it's always the same. And the principles are the same.
And did our previous acharyas like Sixth Ones write any commentaries or some detailed explanations on Manu Sankhita?
No, because Bhagavatam is there.
Mm-hmm.
You want to know the importance, then you just read that 7th canto, instructions of Narada Yudhishthira.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point. Just says all that. We're just going through this so it's understood what is there, so that when you read it in the Bhagavatam, then you understand that everything's already there. That's the whole purpose of it. You go through all these other literatures so you appreciate how Bhagavatam already has all the essence of everything in it. That's the purpose. Then you have faith in Bhagavatam, then one can be a preacher of Bhagavatam. Right? Because unless one has faith in it, one will be a preacher of it. Lord Chaitanya was known as a preacher of Bhagavatam. So that's the whole point. first to have that faith in Bhagavatam.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jaya.
Srila Bhaktivinoda ki.
Jaya.
Jaya Sai Gauru.
Jaya.